lost a new one?
I don't know. I don't care.
Yeah, he probably just forgot. He's probably been drinking all day.
Yeah, it's his birthday. Welcome to the Church of Mavis. Joe played our old song by accident because he's been drinking all day because it's his birthday. He forgot our new song. It's okay, though. I still love that song. That song's actually trapped on my hard drive. I usually listen to that song before every show to get in the voodoo vibe, to get it going. And since my computer crashed, that song's trapped on my computer. So I have to get it off. But first off, before we get to our guest, I have to sing a song for Joe Montalto, the sexiest man-beast alive. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Joe Montalto. Joey. Here's the heavy metal version. All right, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to throw out something.
Yes. Please stop.
All right. Yeah, I just killed myself at 36. I should not do that. But anywho, tonight's guest is Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We're going to be talking about the Dijin. Her book, The Vengeful Dijin, she wrote with Philip Imbrogno. First off, I want to talk about a special show we're going to do tomorrow. I'm still out of breath from doing that. Tomorrow we're going to interview the Hopi Nation. Basically, we have a special show tomorrow at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Remember, Guy, I hope you're awake. And we're going to be interviewing the spokesman of the chief and the medicine man of the Hopi Nation, which I guess, you know, their tribe. I don't think they're the medicine man of, like, all of them, but they have, like, different tribes.
Yeah, and different villages.
Yeah, villages. Yeah. And basically, I was talking to Nancy Redstar, and we're interviewing her next Sunday. We're doing four Sundays in a row. I went crazy and scheduled them, and then we're not for a while, but we'll talk about that another time. We're going to talk to them about some unrest on their reservation. Apparently, there's a group of other natives who are non-traditionalists who are trying to take away their old constitution and the old constitution and their traditions and wipe it out and replace it with a new constitution. And basically, they don't believe in the old tradition. Sounds like they might be aligned with the white man, the Washushu, the enemy, is what I'm learning. I don't know the whole story. I know bits and pieces. It's very complicated. It's being discussed all over the internet right now. Lots of forums. If you put in a Hopi way of life threatened, you'll find lots of conversation about it, and you'll find conversation on our forum at mavisincarnate.com. And basically, we're the first radio show to be breaking the news about it. So I've always admired Native American people, and I have Cherokee roots in my family. And I've studied shamanism for over 10 years. And we've interviewed, it's hard to get shamans on a radio show, but Serge Kahale King was cool when we interviewed him about shamanism. But to have an actual medicine man come and speak to us and the spokesman of the chief is pretty cool. So I'm definitely looking forward to helping them out. And we're making up karma for what the white man did to them. That's what we're doing. We're heroes now to the Hopi. They're going to give us wives. I'm just kidding. They're not. But tomorrow you can. We'll have that show up as soon as it's done. Hopefully soon after it's done, and we'll be talking to the Hopi Nation about their way of life, their traditions, and what these non-traditionalists are trying to do which is basically just get rid of the old way of everything and take over. There's videos of them being thrown out of their community buildings and dragged off by the police. There's like all kinds of YouTube videos of it on the Facebook event on my profile and Nancy Red Star's YouTube channel. And we're going to break it. It's a Geraldo moment, baby. That's what we're going to do. We're going to break it out. And they're going to spread it to all the nations and tribes and all the Native American sites. So we're going to be their platform at Paranormal Radio Network and the Church of Mavis to help the Hopi people. Because that's how we roll. All right.
Yes, sir.
You got anything to say, Guy, before we get to our guest?
Nope. Let's roll.
Let's rock and roll. All right, our guest tonight's Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We're going to be talking about her book, The Vengeful DeGin. She wrote it with Philip Imbrogno. How are you doing, Rosemary?
Oh, all things considered for the winter, I'm doing pretty good, Jeffrey.
Well, that's good. Yeah, you told me you were cold in Connecticut. It's snowing there, is it?
Well, we had a bit of snow yesterday, but, you know, it's piled up pretty deep because we've had a number of pretty good snows back-to-back, but it is so cold. My goodness.
What's the temperature there right now?
It's supposed to hit a low around zero tonight.
Oh, Lord. That's cold for sure. Well, let's start about the book, and then we'll get into some other subjects probably at the second end of the interview. But first off, I just want to know, Rosemary, what inspired you and Philip to do this book? How did you two come up with the collaboration idea and everything?
Phil and I have collaborated on research on a variety of projects, and this book was born out of mutual interest in research. We were initiating some projects related to interdimensional portals, which is the subject of another book that we have coming out at the end of this year. And in the course of having conversations about things that we had poked around in, we discovered that we both had a very strong interest in the djinn. And Phil has had some experiences in the Middle East, and I believe that I have encountered them in some of my own paranormal investigation research, and yet not much seemed to be known about them in and so we felt that it was timely and also instructive to put together a book on these very mysterious, powerful, and hidden beings, which we think are playing a substantial role in the paranormal overall, that they are part of a broad range of paranormal experiences that we have. And because they're not on the radar screen, so to speak, of things that people take into consideration in trying to explain phenomena and events, they really are quite hidden, and it suits their purposes. We think that they have some covert ops agendas, so to speak.
Well, where do they fit in as a difference between, like, let's start off with, like, children's stories and folklore, and is that kind of like an influence from them? Because I know a lot of folklore and legends and stuff are steeped in actual truths that, you know, could exist as far as like vampires and things like that. But what is the difference between these beings and, let's say, children's stories and folklore?
Well, folklore about the djinn that has migrated into the West has pretty watered down. The djinn is the basis of our term genie. Djinn actually means the hidden ones. And when folk tales from the Middle East, old Arabian stories, Persian stories, and whatnot were translated for a European audience, the term djinn became genie. And there are stories coming out of the Middle East that genies can be imprisoned in vessels like bottles. They can be imprisoned in rings. They have many supernatural powers, and if they have been imprisoned and they are released, the idea is that they are required then to grant someone three wishes. And it's not always three, but it's three is the most common. And as a lot of these stories go, the wishes don't go very well for people. First wish is often quite good. The second wish doesn't go so good. And the third wish is often used to undo the other two because things get progressively worse for the person. And so these are the dominant ideas that we know about the jinn, that they're these often kind of silly beings portrayed in these folk tales, solely related to wish granting. But actually they are quite more complex and powerful and certainly deserving of a lot of respect.
So it's jinn. The D is silent. I heard the difference, and I was like, the jinn? I'm from Georgia, so I will chop something up in a minute. So it's jinn, right?
Jinn, and in fact, the most common spelling that many Westerners might be familiar with is just J-I-N-N. We prefer to use the more correct spelling, D-J-I-N-N, but they're both pronounced the same. And jinn refers to plural. A single entity would be called a jinni. And that, of course, is very close to the term from the folktale translation, genie.
So are there good jinn, or are they all evil? I mean, you've seen Aladdin, right?
Well,
Oh, what was that? I have no idea what that noise was. It wasn't me.
And there are stories from folklore where, you know, the jinn wind up being quite helpful. But we think that they're very much like human beings. They come in all stripes and persuasions. They're the good, the bad, and the ugly, so to speak. There are benign ones, very enlightened ones, very immature ones that are very trickster-like, who like to engage human beings in games and tricks and mischief, that sort of thing. And then there are the supernatural terrorists who don't particularly care for human beings, are very hostile to human beings, and act out against us in very aggressive ways, considering that most of the time they keep themselves hidden and invisible, and they do have supernatural powers, they can become rather formidable entities to come across.
So you and Philip, you have actual testimonies from people that have come across these beings? Or, like, experienced them?
Yes, we do. And, of course, in Middle Eastern cultures, where beliefs about these entities are still very strong today, they are automatically considered as the explanations for cases such as tricky or malevolent hauntings, interference in daily life, bad luck, bad things happening, illness, even cases of possession. They're considered to be entities that you don't want to cross. It's best to avoid them. They can be conjured in magic. There are all sorts of rituals for trying to conjure up the jinn, as some people might conjure up other kinds of spirits, and like we have in Western magic. But we think that those sorts of things are not limited to the Middle East, that they are throughout the world. We think the jinn are everywhere. And what we did was we took a lot of cases that both of us have come across in our own investigations, as well as cases from other researchers that we consult with, cases that have sort of defied explanation in terms of what's really going on, you know, because a lot of times things don't quite seem to fit the ghost, poltergeist, demon, fairy sort of explanation. And could these cases be explained as jinn? And we believe that very strong cases can be made for the jinn being very active in paranormally engaging human beings, so to speak. So can we prove any of this? Well, of course, how do you prove an entity is any sort of entity? Human beings clearly have had interactions with supernatural entities throughout history. And the behaviors and characteristics and patterns are consistent, but our terminology explaining those entities often shifts according to our cultural and religious beliefs. So we make a very good case for the jinn. And I do believe that they are active in a lot of cases that paranormal investigators are taking on today in the West. So with the book, The Vengeful Jinn, we're seeking to educate the Western audience that here's an entity that is interacting with human beings the way we think other entities are. This has been going on a very long time. Here are the characteristics and traits, and they should be taken into consideration because they're different than demons. They're not the same as demons, and oftentimes it requires a different approach to dealing with them in terms of trying to relieve some phenomena or help someone who's having some trouble, some paranormal trouble.
Well, someone that comes across these beings, what could they do to protect themselves from it or to banish it, so to speak?
I think that it's very difficult to get rid of jinn. Some jinn will act out in very specific ways against people. They can attach to people the same way other spirits can. And they do cause possession cases. But the ones that seem to cause the most difficulty are entities that we think are more attached to interdimensional portals. That is, there are places or territories where they come and go between worlds, and it's like having a foot in different dimensions. And human beings come along and want to occupy the same space, and this stirs up a whole lot of paranormal trouble. It's extremely difficult to get rid of entities in that case, and in fact, that applies to a lot of entities across the board, not just jinn. You're not going to push them out with traditional exorcism rituals. According to Eastern folklore, the jinn come in a variety of even religious persuasions. There are Christian and Jewish and Muslim jinn. There are atheist jinn. And so what we seem to do is we seem to, our approach to a hostile entity situation is we storm on the scene with traditional exorcism techniques that are Christian-based. They're not always going to do the trick. So it behooves us to study some exorcism techniques from other cultures. The jinn can be forced out in possession in some cases, but in other cases they require more bargaining, and that's something that Western exorcists are not used to doing. They're more used to compelling things, ordering things to go and in the name of certain religious rites. And that's not always going to work against the jinn. And sometimes you're just not going to get rid of them. So you have to make decisions about how you're going to cope.
So with the jinn, is it, when you say barter with them or appease, is that kind of like in Asian cultures where they try to appease the spirits and leave different things around to, I guess, to appease them? I'm trying to think of the different things they do, like, sacrifices. They leave honey or flowers or something. What do you barter? How do you barter with these creatures?
You have to approach something from a context that is familiar with. And, of course, there are lots of exorcism rituals around the world where all kinds of negotiation and bartering is done. You know, spirits want different things. They either want territory or to be left alone, or they want some sort of food or other offering. And so it depends on the cases. Some of the most persistent cases that I've investigated that I think are jinn-based, the jinn can be temporarily appeased with all kinds of offerings. We've tried Native American tobacco and because they do appreciate the incense from smoke you know, other things like that. But bottom line is some of them just don't go away. And they're far more powerful than human beings. And if they want to occupy an interdimensional space and they consider you to be a parasite in their house, like we would consider mice or cockroaches to be parasites in our house, well, you can see their perspective.
So I know I read on the book that you had a map of some locations of some of these interdimensional portals for these the jinn, right?
Well, we don't have like a map where we pinpoint places around the earth, but we do believe that there are geographic locations that serve as interdimensional portals where jinn and other entities seem to have easier access to this world. And some of the ones that we've investigated that we feature in the book would be the Hudson Valley in upstate New York, the Bridgewater Triangle, Massachusetts. I think that the Appalachians, starting in lower Pennsylvania, the Alleghenies, and going on down into West Virginia, are major jinn corridors. And there probably are other pockets around as well. The Skinwalker Ranch in Utah might be one of these cases as well. And it's, I think the earth is literally pockmarked with interdimensional portals, and one of the hallmarks of these places is a long history of a wide variety of paranormal activity. That extends across the board. You have UFOs, Bigfoot, mysterious creatures, ghosts and hauntings, bad luck, areas that are considered to be cursed, where people just have all sorts of experiences, and quite often they're not pleasant experiences. And they seem to be very concentrated in certain locales. And we find that many of these areas share similar geographic traits. They're in remote areas, they're desert areas, mountainous areas, areas riddled with underground tunnels, subterranean water, abandoned mine shafts, negative magnetic anomalies, high concentrations of iron, magnetite, quartz, and things like that. It's very imprecise, but the patterns do exist.
Well, I noticed. Oh, go ahead, Guy.
Hey, Rosemary, this is Guy. Hey, yeah. Couldn't like demons and you know, the Christian view of things just be the Western world version of the jinn?
Well, possibly. Are we really dealing with the same kind of entity? I think that in the West, what we usually define as a demon is a very narrow perspective of the demonic universe. I call these entities actually satanic demons rather than demons, because we have this idea that demons are thoroughly evil entities dedicated to subverting the soul, and that they all work for Satan. Well, this is a very narrow definition of demons. And outside of that, the demonic universe is quite diverse. Not all demons, I do not think that all demons are working for Satan. In fact, before Christianity developed the concept of Satan, mythologies were full of folklore and beliefs about demons, that is, interfering entities, who were of all persuasions. The Greek concept of the daemonis, they could be benign or malevolent. And in fact, some of them could even provide good counsel, but they always seem to have a tricky sort of nature. Demons, as they've been defined in most mythologies and folklores, are interfering, usually in negative ways, and they've often been blamed for all the bad things that happen to people. But, you know, ancient people who were not Christians wouldn't have considered the concept of demons working for Satan would have been totally unknown to them. So Christianity has really skewed our concepts of demons. And I think that these entities are out there, the satanic demons, but they're not the only entities out there interfering with the course of events and the environment. So we need to broaden our perspective. I guess that's a long answer to your question.
Anything else, Guy?
No, go ahead, Ben.
Well, when it comes to the djinn, I noticed on the book the appearance that he seems bearded, and I automatically kind of got an Eastern feel. Is there a general appearance to them, or I keep thinking of different movies. I know there's I see a lot of horror movies use the djinn in them. Wishmaster by Wes Craven, where that's the whole story where they the victim, you know, does the wish, and then he like totally screws them out of the wish and does something insane and kills them. And then I know there's a movie called Djinn. I haven't seen it. It looked kind of cheesy. I know there's another one coming out this year called, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Dibuque Box, D-I-B-B-U-K Box, and I believe it's about a djinn. Now, it looks like it might be pretty good and well done on some level, but as far as their appearance and the wish factor, let's get to the appearance first. Is there a general appearance to them that you know of, or is it just kind of like they look like humans? Anyway, anything can go.
Well, I want to address one thing first, the Dybbuk. The movie you're referring to, the Dybbuk Box, D-I-B-B-U-K, it's a phonetic spelling. It's usually spelled D-Y-B-B-U-K, and that's a Jewish entity. It's a malevolent entity, sometimes a malevolent soul of the dead. So it's not really the same as the djinn. Now, these interfering entities share common characteristics across the board of hostile acts and interferences that create problems. So how do you know whether you're dealing with a demon or a djinn? It's often a very tough call to make. But the Dybbuk is an entirely different entity, and I wasn't asked to work on the movie project, but I was asked to work on a book project related to the movie about Dybbuks, and for various reasons I didn't take it on, but it's another entity that's not very well known in what I would say the Christian Western lore. But the djinn, their appearance, nobody really knows what they look like in their original state. According to Middle Eastern tradition, they were born of smokeless fire. And the Quran addresses the djinn. And there's an entire chapter devoted to the djinn and numerous references made to them in the Quran. Smokeless fire could be translated in modern terms as beings of plasma. And they do have the ability to shapeshift. They can shapeshift into any form, like a lot of other spirits. They can take on human form. They can take on monstrous forms. We think that some of our mysterious creatures, some of the entities that we call cryptids, might be djinn in disguise. In Middle Eastern lore, some of their favored forms are snakes and black dogs. reptilian sorts of appearances, but they can look very beautiful and seductive in human form as well. There are different types of jinn, and we find descriptions of them from Middle Eastern lore. There are some that are sort of half human, half half monster. The ghoul is a type of jinn, an entity that roams around deserted areas and tombs and, you know, feeds off people and the dead, would be a type of jinn. So it's quite a range of appearances, but most of the time I think they're invisible. We have a sense of their presence. They can make themselves known. Psychics might be able to get clairvoyant impressions of them, and the form that they take probably suits the circumstances that they're engaged in.
So where does the wishes and stuff, is that basically from just children's tales and folklore? Does that fit in any way into the jinn reality of them actually existing? Do they use that type of manipulation or grant wishes, or is that just all like Disney?
Well, actually, Disney adapted very old Arabian folktales, so it's not just kiddie stuff. The Arabian folktales, going back to ancient times, and they do deal with wish granting, but that's not the only thing that the jinn are involved in. There are people today who feel that the jinn can be coerced into objects such as jars and bottles. You can go on the internet and peruse the Middle Eastern press and find stories just about any day of the week of people who claim to be able to conjure and trap these entities. And you can buy rituals on the internet, supposedly for forcing the jinn to grant wishes. It's not something that I recommend. I don't recommend spirit conjuring in general, because most entities who are engaged in this way have a very trickster nature to them, and things can often backfire, which of course is the backbone a lot of the old folklore tales, that the jinn don't appreciate being treated that way, and if they can find a way to turn wishes against someone, they will. Now there's a tradition for that in the Solomonic lore as well, because the legendary king Solomon supposedly enslaved the jinn to build his temple of Jerusalem and even the entire city of Jerusalem. Now, Western translations of this tale, which is described in the most detail in an ex-canonical text called the Testament of Solomon, the Western term that usually is used in translation is demon. It's Solomon commanded the demons, but the original term is the jinn. And he was able to do so. Solomon asked God for discernment and wisdom, and so God granted him dominion over entities, including the jinn, and he commanded the jinn with a magical ring, which is also part of the basis of some of the early tales about them. He had a magical ring, and it was inscribed at the pentacle. It's made out of copper and iron, which are two metals that in folklore have the ability to diminish or quell the powers of the jinn. We also find that in fairy lore as well. Iron is held to have power against all sorts of entities. And he would summon them and demand that they tell their names, their backgrounds, their characteristics, the sorts of things they could do, and then he would set them to making tasks, such as cutting marble and transporting marble and actually doing the slave labor. And there are all kinds of tales about how the jinn resented this, and they tried to find ways out of it. The magical text called the Key of Solomon in folklore is the handed down tradition of some of these rituals that can be used to summon up entities for various purposes.
Mm.
Now, there's one version of that story that says that falsehoods have been put into this key so that human beings would not know the true ways to conjure entities. And that there are other stories that the essence of true ability to engage with the spirits can be found in this text as well. So those are some of the early foundations of our awareness of jinn and how human beings have engaged with them.
So were they actual physical beings before being, you know, sent off somewhere else that inhabited here? Physically inhabited the earth?
Well, a physical might not be the best description. If you're created from plasma, your natural form is going to be something incorporeal. According to the Quran, God created angels from a very pure spiritual light, created the jinn from smokeless fire, which in modern physics terms would be the plasma, and human beings from earth and water, you know, clay. And the story goes that when God made human beings, he instructed the angels to bow before his new creation. And the angels did so. But Iblis, who was in heaven and was the leader of the jinn, refused because he said that human beings were inferior, morally, especially morally inferior. And he saw no reason to bow to them. And for this, he and his kind were cast out of heaven. Now, does this mean that the jinn were in heaven? Were they a type of angel? There are explanations of the jinn being very comparable to fallen angels. I don't think that they're one and the same. But at least Iblis, who is the leader of the jinn, had access to the heavenly realm. And so he and his kind were cast out. And Iblis asked for a chance to redeem himself and his kind by proving that human beings would be unworthy. And so God granted the jinn that favor, that they would have until the judgment day to redeem themselves. And Iblis vowed to show that human beings were spiritually and morally unworthy. And so the negative aspects of the jinn, who are often called devils in that description, would be comparable to demons in our view of things, that they do interfere in negative ways and often in spiritual and moral interferences as well. But that's one explanation for what happened to the jinn. So a modern way of explaining that would be, you know, they were cast out and sent into another dimension. They were cast out from heaven. They were cast out from the earth, which was given to human beings. And so they exist in another dimensional realm. And this is where we think that some of the jinn want our realm back. They consider this to be rightfully theirs and are acting out in ways to recover that, or to try this other agenda of demonstrating that human beings are not worthy to have the paradise that was given to us.
I find Solomon fascinating. I recently, a few days ago, was looking at have the Grail Tarot, I think it's by John Matthews, and pulled the Solomon card, and I've studied about him a bit. I'm no expert, but he's definitely very, very fascinating. And I came across a big file on one of these torrent sites of all these cult books, and I was looking through it, and it had a lot of the books you mentioned about Solomon. I haven't read them, but I was flipping through them and was like, whoa, this is some deep stuff here. But yeah, Solomon's definitely, and it spoke about you know, God giving him power over all the denizens of the earth, and definitely, I know a lot of people who practice magic, you know, are into Solomon pretty hardcore. I have some a documentary about him that's magic based. I never got around to watching it, but he's definitely an interesting biblical Merlin type, I guess you could say. As far as when you were talking about the head djinn talking to God about humans, it kind of reminded me of the Job story. Is it? So do you think it's a separate story compared to, like, Satan and all that stuff? It's like a, I mean, there's some similarities, aren't there, in some ways?
There are similarities, and sometimes the assumption is made that they're the same. You know, Iblis would be comparable to Satan, you know, our concept of Satan, which actually grew out of the term Satan or adversary or tester, and concepts of the devil was something that evolved uniquely through Christianity. So Iblis isn't quite the same as Satan in terms of a ruler of hell and dedicated to absolute evil. The followers of Iblis are often described as devils, which would be comparable to demons, and they can act in ways comparable to demons. But there are other types of jinn as well. And in folklore, the jinn have very long lifespans, much longer than human beings, and they have the capability of, they marry and have children and families and clans. They have the capability of pursuing spiritual enlightenment just like we do. And so not all of them really want anything to do with humans. We think that there are some jinn that are content in their own realm. They don't want to engage with human beings, especially if they consider us to be a lesser life form. And they have very little to do with us. And others are more like fairies. We think that a lot of the fairy lore could be considered jinn lore because fairies are tricksters. They're often hostile to human beings, or they're very enamored with human beings and follow them around, often fall in love with them, do a lot of prankish sorts of things. And then there are jinn that act in more demonic ways. By causing lots of problems. So it becomes very difficult to have we can't really have a universal definition of them. We tend to look at the paranormal as, we want it to be black and white. We want things to be neatly defined with boundaries and borders. And I think this applies throughout all of our entity encounters. You can't simply treat things that way because it's a very blurry territory, and especially when you're dealing with shape-shifting entities, it's often difficult to know exactly what you're up against.
So you don't know of a...
Go ahead.
You don't know of a specific way to, say, identify a jinn from another entity?
Well, sometimes it's a difficult call to make, and one of the things that seems to have stood out over years of investigating, I do a lot of original field investigations, and there are what I call hallmarks of jinn that stand out. They tend to be in areas... The places where people have the most problems with them, they tend to be in these areas that are what I call broad spectrum portal areas. They're very persistent. They can cause a whole range of things, from health problems to poltergeist effects, malevolent haunting sorts of things. They can interfere with your health. They might even be shadow people. Shadow people could be a form that they would take. And it's often very difficult to get rid of them. And that's often the case with demonic entities too. But if you're dealing with an entity that's not responding to traditional approaches of banishment, Christian exorcisms and that sort of thing, and it has certain other characteristics, you might be dealing with a jinn. I've got cases that I've investigated long-term over a period of years where I believe that the dominant interfering entity is a jinn or perhaps a group of jinn, and they just don't go away. They might lay low for a while, but then they come back and start the cycle of problems again. And what we usually see in these areas are people, patterns of people moving, that they just don't stay. It just becomes too much for them, and so they leave. And oftentimes when they leave these areas, then the problems abate. So unfortunately, there's no real good solution for a lot of these cases. We find this in fairy lore as well. You know, there's very strong beliefs about fairies that you don't go and put your house on top of a fairy house, a fairy rat, because the fairies become very angry that you've transgressed on their property, and they will bring wrath and ruin down upon you. And there are many stories in fairy lore of these sorts of things happening. What Phil and I did in The Vengeful Djinn was after we described the djinn and their characteristics and how they interact with people, we take that template and we apply it to other kinds of paranormal phenomena. How can we explain ghosts, hauntings, angels, demons, fairies, extraterrestrials, and mysterious creatures and shadow people by the djinn template? And there's a very good fit with a lot of these, especially with ETs, with mysterious creatures, with fairies, and with shadow people. Are we saying that all shadow people, ETs, mysterious creatures, and fairies are djinn? No, we're not, but we are saying that the djinn may take on those characteristics as ways of getting at people.
Interesting. So I guess a lot of, you know, in ufology, a lot of people want to tie in aliens and fairies, and there's a lot of stories that make sense. Even Jacques Vallée, you know, the French scientist who is pretty well respected, has wrote books about comparing the fairies taking you to their world to alien abduction and things like that. Are there any stories with the djinn of them abducting people too? Do they do that?
There are stories like that, and in fact, some of the modern cases that I have, people feel they feel that the entity who is, I guess I would say, after them, so to speak, wants to take them somewhere, and they feel it's not going to be a very pleasant experience. There are beliefs about the djinn intermarrying with human beings, that they are capable of doing so, just like the fairies, just like ETs. In Middle Eastern belief, the children, the offspring of these unions would be considered either supernatural beings or even abominations, that this would be a union that would not be desirable. So there are many ways that the djinn can have interactions with us. And what we're saying in The Vengeful Djinn is that we think we might be dealing with fairies or cryptids or demons or extraterrestrials, when in fact there may be an entity behind the mask. It may be something else altogether. And yes, you're quite right about the comparison between extraterrestrials and fairies. Remarkable similarities. And Vallée was not the only one to make those comparisons. You know, Thomas Bullard, a folklorist, has done the same. The thing is that when you start looking at our contact with other entities outside of
Western lore and other cultures. You find the same characteristics going on, but people have different ways of describing these entities. And so how do we know whether we're dealing with a fairy or an extraterrestrial or something else? It's often not possible to say exactly that it's an apple or an orange. Rather, the answer is there seems to be an entity out there who engages with human beings in certain ways, and various cultures have identified that entity in certain ways, but they all act toward human beings in the same way. There seem to be entities who are interested in dealing with us, either to push us out of our territory or to attach themselves to us, to have physical experiences through us, to engage with us sexually for the purpose of pleasure or producing offspring, and also take us away into their realm. That seems taking us into their realm seems to be less a characteristic with the jinn than some other kinds of entities we've engaged with, but it's not out of the question.
They want us out of their realm. They don't want to take us there.
Yeah, that's to be at least the cases that that I've been dealing with and that Phil has come across. And a lot of times we're dealing with you know cases that are brought to our attention. We think we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg. That a lot of the persistent, what we would call negative hauntings, are in areas that have long histories and are resistant to various therapies and remedies, so to speak. In other words, you're not going to make whatever is there go away. You might get it to lay low for a while, but it's not going to go away, and so you either put up with it or you go away. And quite often it's the people who go away. There are certain corridors, for example, in these what we think are these portal areas, where there's a high turnover of home ownership, and people move into what they think are beautiful, bucolic sorts of places, and they wind up with a hornet's nest of paranormal phenomena on their hands. Now, also there's a human factor involved, because people who seem to have more openness to the spiritual realms are going to have more problems than other people. So there's a human psychic trigger factor involved too. But quite often in the portal areas, even people who consider themselves to be, you know, psychic as a stone, so to speak, which I don't think is the case. I think everybody's psychic to at least some degree. Might have minimal problems, where a person who's been open to the spirit realms, especially since childhood, is likely to have major problems. And there could simply be something in their energy field that activates these things more, or you know, you sort of come onto their radar screen in a different way that enables them to be more pronounced in the physical environment.
Yeah, you just described me to a T.
Go ahead, Guy.
I just said you just described me to a T. Hey, Rosemary, we got about 3 minutes before we go on break.
Uh-huh.
You got something real quick you can...
We have three minutes before we go on our 10-minute break.
Well, I would like to mention my website, visionaryliving.com. I have a page devoted to the jinn. The Vengeful Jinn will be available beginning in mid-February. And Phil and I have set up a website which will be launching at the start of February called jinnuniverse.com. And we intend this as an educational site with excerpts from the book, articles, mainly for Western audiences to begin to have jinn awareness. And we are encouraging people to learn about the jinn, especially people in the paranormal community who are investigating cases. We think that this needs to be part of our paranormal vocabulary.
I agree with you, but
it's we're like going to take a break for 10 minutes, and you can just stay by the phone, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
What'd you say, Guy?
I was just saying that the paranormal field isn't really an exact science, you know.
That's very true. And every case has to be assessed.
It's not Halloween. Oh, I'm echoing. He's playing our new song. This is Jack, and then I'm echoing. Never rub another man's rhubarb. All right, let me quit pacing and go back to my chair. Welcome back to the Church of Mavis. Coming to you live tonight in Florida. Guys in Philly. Rosemary's, I believe, in Connecticut. We're moshing to the apocalypse, baby, because that's what we do. So, Rosemary, are you there?
I am. Before we went to break, did we get in about the websites, or should I announce those again?
Yeah, we got those. We'll get them from you again at the end, too, one more time. I want to get into the vampire topic. I have a vampire fascination. Since high school, people called me a vampire because I'm pale. I have a Dracula tattoo. I went through... When I was in high school, I had cancer, and I went through chemo, and I latched on the Anne Rice books to, like, and I became obsessed with vampires. I was 17 going through chemo, so I was reading these Anne Rice books, and I believe I latched on to them so much, I, like, turned into a vampire on some level during that time. And when I came back from school, that was my new nickname. So ever since then, I've had a fascination. I know you've read a book about vampires, too, right?
I've actually written three books on vampires, including an encyclopedia. And when people ask me, you know, what's my favorite thing that I've investigated, well, vampires are right up there because the folklore about them is so intriguing. And they are probably one of the entities that holds the most fascination for us.
Well, as far as your, I know you wrote one book where you got kind of into the vampire culture as far as people that, like the gothic kind of scene, right, and things like that.
My first book on vampires was called Vampires Among Us, and I did the research for that in the late 1980s around, you know, into the early 1990s. And the vampire subculture really hadn't emerged in any cohesive sort of way at that time. But there were a lot of people who looking for fellow vampires, you know, people who considered themselves to be vampires or who wanted to be vampires. And, of course, back then a lot of them were also attracted to the goth subculture and believed that they could find like-minded individuals in the goth clubs and that sort of thing. And there's still that element today, but vampire subculture has broadened out considerably from that. But it was a very interesting odyssey to go around and interview people on why they wanted to be vampires or why they thought they were vampires. And they ran the gamut from what would be called the fashion vampires, people who just kind of wanted a vampire lifestyle and the trappings of it, as they defined as perceived from mostly fiction, people who thought they were born vampires, and then people who thought that they had to be turned into vampires through some sort of blood ritual or some sort of initiation.
So what are some of the folklore stories that that you know of that are very interesting of actual vampires?
I believe in vampires as real entities. Of course, I believe that about the paranormal in general. I don't think you can cherry-pick things. If you believe in one thing, you have to be at least open to the possibility of another. But I think that vampiric entities have been around a long time, just like demonic entities. And in the broadest sense, the vampire is an entity that takes the life force, and that there are many ways to do that besides blood. You can take the life force by sucking off somebody's health, by taking their beauty, their wealth, their good luck. And in fact, the folklore stories about vampires are very similar to demonic stories, and even things that were blamed on witches and sorcerers. Vampires could light your crops, kill your animals, ruin your livelihood, cause butter not to churn, bees not to give honey, you know, that sort of thing. But chiefly, vampires were associated with predations upon human beings, ruining somebody's health, taking their life, that might be through blood, but it could be through some sort of nighttime visitation that just had a wasting effect on your health. In fiction, vampires have tended to follow the Bram Stoker Dracula model, and the real vampire that we find in folklore is much different than Count Dracula, much broader, far more insidious, I would say. So the fictional vampire, I don't put a whole lot of stock in, but real vampires, yes. And there are many entities who are vampiric in nature. You could call them vampires because of the way they take the essence of the life force. But they might also have other kinds of names in different mythologies and folklores.
Well, a lot of people want to make Vlad the Impaler and stuff like that, like the king of vampires, and, you know, that's really wasn't what he was. He's more of just a tyrant. But there are some weird stories about him supposedly meeting the devil in Scaramance. I think I said that right, and some dark art school, which is kind of weird, that kind of feeds into the vampire thing. But where do you think the whole vampire birth takes place, as far as, like, is it folklore? Is that where it all started, pretty much?
We find vampire entities in mythologies everywhere. Everybody has these sorts of negative entities that feed off the life force. Our concept of vampires evolved primarily out of Eastern European beliefs, which were very specific. And they had to do a lot with the returning dead, that if you died under certain circumstances, or you weren't properly buried, or for a host of reasons, you didn't make it into the afterlife, you might have the ability to escape your grave and come back and prey upon the living. The predatory dead is a universal concept that we find since ancient times, that the dead are unhappy in their afterlife state or their death state, and want to come back and have the same pleasures that the living had. In the folklore accounts of vampires, quite often what they want is sex, and they come back and start having sex with their spouses, their family members, other people in the village, or they might bring epidemic and plague. They might cause poltergeist disturbances, nightmares. The vampire really bleeds across a lot of other negative entity types of characteristics and behavior. But the dominant trait from Eastern European lore was not a supernatural non-human entity, but the returning dead, the malevolent returning dead. And descriptions of how they came back varied. Sometimes they were described as specters or apparitions, that is, the spirit of a dead person, but who could be recognized as such. Sometimes they were described as seeming to be solid. And, of course, we have many cases from ghost lore of people encountering ghosts, and they seem to be very real, not transparent or filmy. They have that ability. And the vampire could plague the living under certain conditions or for certain periods of time, and beliefs about this varied.
that if someone was escaping the grave, they had sometimes they had a limited window in their ability to return to the living before they would just kind of run their battery down, so to speak. Or they had to be dealt with in certain ways. And how you stopped a spirit from walking was through a form of sympathetic magic, which is quite universal, that a body, a corpse, sustains the spirit. And so if you dug up the body and mutilated it or burned it or hacked it up, then you would interfere with the spirit's ability to walk in the world.
So you think maybe vampires were just vampires in itself could maybe be just a behavior of other entities, say djinn or demons or something like that, that are feeding off of, you know, feeding off of people? Or do you think they're actual?
There certainly are vampiric characteristics. For example, a djinn who interferes with somebody's health, that would be a vampiric characteristic. Vampires in Eastern Europe were blamed for plagues and illnesses and blights and things like that. If you deteriorate somebody's health, you are taking the life force from them. You're taking their ability to be healthy and vital in the world. So that's a vampiric trait. But would the djinn be called vampires? Well, here again we get into semantics. And what's an apple in one culture at one time is an orange in another, but they act in the same ways. And in fact, when I was looking at folklore accounts of people's descriptions of how they were attacked by vampires, you could substitute a whole lot of entity terms for vampire and have the same experience. Where do you separate the difference between a nightmare demon and a vampire, for example, or a succubus or an incubus and a vampire? It becomes very difficult to do that. So there are traits that are shared across the board, and in certain cultures, this was called a vampire. Now, there were also other folklore beliefs from Eastern Europe about living people who were vampires, and in other cultures, they would have been called, a witch or a sorcerer, something like that, but they were described in certain periods of time as a type of vampire.
Ex-wife, ex-husband.
But some of the stories are quite interesting. And I ran into a whole class of vampires from South America that they're fat vampires. They don't want your blood. They want your fat. And these exist in the folklore beliefs of the residents of the Andes Mountains. They're living at very high altitudes. And you can imagine that in order to survive the harsh climate, you need some body fat on you. If you lose your body fat, you're not going to be in very good health. And so the vampiric entities who prey on these people suck off the body fat, sort of a Western diet vampire, I guess. But this
so they eat. They just they eat the body fat like they train the
They take body fat, and they don't touch. They're not interested in your blood, but they take your body fat, and that's how they waste your health, and that's how they kill you. So there are also vampires who are breath suckers and breathers, and we find some of those in Scottish lore. It gets tied in with the malevolent fairies. Asian vampires are toxic breathers. They either kill you by breathing on you, noxious breath, and that's how they kill you, or they use their breath to suck the soul out of you. So the vampire is quite a varied character, far more complex than the fanged blood drinker that got passed down into our pop culture.
So some of these people... people that believe they're vampires, could they possibly have some sort of being inhabiting them on some level and using their body or something? Not all of them, of course, but there's some folks out there, you know, definitely that, you know, say they're vampires that are pretty freaking out there, and there's a possibility, there's definitely a high strangeness to them, and I could see maybe some kind of being using them for a host, maybe, or something to that effect.
I think all kinds of entities could try to use human beings for hosts, and we couldn't rule that out about vampires. In the folklore, and I'm speaking, when I talk about the folklore, I'm talking primarily about the Mediterranean, Eastern European beliefs that have evolved into our present-day modern, you know, pop culture and folklore beliefs about vampires. They're not immortal. They don't walk around in resurrected bodies out of coffins. Some of them have, like I said, limited viabilities where they can act out in negative ways, and then eventually they run out of steam, like a battery running out, or they're dispatched by destroying the physical vehicle believed to sustain them. And that was the custom of in Eastern Europe of digging up the bodies and looking for signs of incorruption. That was considered to be an unnatural state that sustained the vampire. The vampire needed a physical host to remain viable in terms of attacking the living. So here again, it's very difficult to describe or define the vampire in a very narrow definition. And that's why I say that an entity that takes the life force is probably the best definition of a vampire.
Well, I could definitely see a djinn or some type of demonic being, you know, they're trickster beings. I mean, if I was a trickster being, I could, you know, see resurrecting a body and messing with people. That would be, you know, kind of fun, I guess, if I were evil or whatever.
It'd take a lot of energy.
Yeah, and, you know, there's some story I have that book, Vampire in Eastern Europe, or some book. It talks about like Peter Plugovich or something. I can't remember his name. Does that name ring a bell?
Peter Plugovich? That was a case, I think it was from, I'm trying to remember the century. It might have been like the 1500s. Montague Summers was...
Yeah, that's him. That's the book.
Yeah, he wrote a couple of books on vampires, and of course, some of these cases were cataloged by other researchers as well. It was in the first part of the 18th century that vampires became known outside of these rural areas in Eastern Europe, and they just fascinated researchers and other people. Of course, they were adopted right away into the performing arts because they're a wonderful sort of, villain to have. But the Peter Plogowitz, not sure how to pronounce it, that was a Serbian case, and he died, he was like, kind of an elderly man, I think he was in his 60s, and he died, and several days after he died, he appeared in his home as presumably a specter and asked for food. And his son gave him food to eat, and then he kept coming back asking for more food, and this terrified the son. So he started refusing him. And at that point, the specter became very malevolent, and the son died. In local belief, made this returning specter a vampire. And other people in the village fell ill. They became exhausted. They felt that their vitality was being taken. Their blood was being weakened. There were descriptions of this spirit coming into people's bedrooms at night and biting them and sucking the blood out of their wounds. In a lot of descriptions, it's very inexact how the vampire takes your vitality. But in this case, we had descriptions of the actual blood sucking. The widow had experiences with him at night. And so he was dug up and found to be in this incorrupt state and was dispatched. I think his corpse was burned, as I recall. And one of the things was he had demanded that his widow give him his shoes. This sounds like something a ghost would do rather than a vampire, but you see that these cases are not Dracula cookie cutter cases. They, you know, embody other kinds of characteristics. So just to be on the safe side, when they burned his corpse, they burned his shoes too, thinking that.
Give me my shoes and a burger.
Right.
And some Funyuns, man.
Yeah, they're definitely fascinating. Some of these people went crazy with the vampire craze, though. They kind of went nutter butter, didn't they, on it? Like the witch burnings and stuff. They kind of went overboard possibly with it a little bit. I know there's bells and coffins and stuff, like you ring a bell if you're alive in the coffin from back in the day. I forget what they called it, but they would put a string in the coffin, and if you woke up, I guess if you were dead, you'd ring the bell.
Yeah, there's some speculation that vampires might have been just people who were accidentally buried alive because they were thought to be dead. I think that really explains what I would call the classic vampire cases, which really were people returning from the dead in some form or another. But when especially an epidemic went through a village, it was often strongly believed that a vampire was causing this, was causing the wasting sickness. And so in order to stop the epidemic, of course, they didn't understand about bacteria and viruses and things like that. The remedy would be to find the dead person who was responsible, and you had to maybe even dig up a bunch of bodies if you didn't know exactly who it was. If a number of people had died, you had to dig up a bunch of bodies. Well, of course, the Westerners who came to investigate these cases considered this to be quite barbaric and repugnant and very primitive. And in fact, the Christian Church, as it slowly spread through Europe, some of these rural areas which were more resistant to Christianization, the church tried to stamp out vampirism, considering it to be a disgusting pagan practice. And in many cases, couldn't, so the church adapted, just like the church adapted itself to a lot of pagan holidays. And argued that, well, all right, if you're going to dig up bodies like this, it has to be done by a priest, and the only things that are going to work against this evil are symbols of Christianity, the crucifix, holy water, and things like that. And so we have these Christian elements that got grafted onto a very pagan practice. You know, the pagans didn't deal with vampires with holy water and crosses. They had other ways of dealing with vampires. So the idea that vampires recoil in front of a crucifix and burn, you know, when they're splashed with holy water, these are all pretty much fiction embellishments on those practices. One of the most interesting cases I came across, and this just goes to show how unglamorous some of these things were, I call them the diarrhea vampires. And this was a case that would occur periodically off on an island off the coast of what used to be Yugoslavia, and periodically would be this epidemic of killing diarrhea. That would be the dominant characteristic. That's how people would die, this almost like a dysentery sort of thing. And so the villagers would go around digging up these bodies looking for the diarrhea vampires. That's literally what they were after. And the one case, how I found this case, was because some of the vampire hunters were arrested. This was very much against the rules of the church, and so when these people were digging up graves, they were caught, they were charged with desecrating graves, and their punishment wasn't all that severe. They were forced to go to church, you know, every Sunday for a year, and to make public apologies, and to, you know, say certain prayers and things like that. But it was all about diarrhea, and not the glamorous stuff that...
No, it's not the aristocrat wolf thought, that's for sure.
Something Spielberg is going to make into a movie, you know. So we have the whole fictional vampire has taken its own evolution, where the fictional vampire retains certain characteristics of the folklore vampire, but so many other elements introduced, like the death by sunlight, that was entirely an invention of the silent film Nosferatu, which was a plagiarism of Dracula. Recoiling before the symbols of Christianity, walking around in flesh and blood bodies, immortality, so the whole superpower thing is just a total invention of fiction. Vampires had, because they were specters returning from the grave, they did have abilities that went beyond the physical, like being able to cause nightmares, sexual predations by invisible entities, the wasting of health. But nobody back then was talking about vampires having, you know, supernormal strength, telepathy, clairvoyance, instant transportation, flying through the air. These are all fictional inventions.
I don't know, Rosemary. Giving somebody the power to give somebody diarrhea is a superpower, man. If you think about it, you could cause some serious damage.
It's not very pleasant. You'd
clear a room pretty quick.
So, Rosemary, when it comes to demons and Satan, Christians have their view of that. In your experience, do you think there is a being who is the source of most of the evil, like a Satan-type being in the world?
I think that there are... entities who seem to embody the forces of chaos, malevolence, and evil. And different cultures at various times in history have coalesced these beliefs around certain deities, and ours coalesce around an entity we call Satan, which actually has had a very long evolution in the church. And it's I mean, I can see why Christianity needs something like a Satan to be the organizer of everything evil. But there are other evil forces as well. And outside of Christianity, we find, you know, in pantheons of deities, there's usually a variety of gods and also goddesses who personify the forces of darkness. And these are part of the natural order of things, that you have the forces of chaos and darkness that tear things down and destroy things, and then you have the forces that build and create, and it's a turning wheel. So I think... I think our a concept of the devil, you know, we've put all of that into this single entity. And do these forces exist? Yeah, I think that they exist. And I think absolute evil exists. And that these forces are personified in various ways. Whether or not they're actual entities or personifications of forces, it may be something that we can't ascertain. We have to deal with these things in certain ways. And throughout history, human beings have personified these forces in gods and goddesses and entities. So I think it's a very murky area.
When someone says they're a demonologist, is that someone that just categorizes these beings, or is that, are there ones out there who like actually invoke them and try to do evil stuff, like, you know, wizards and stuff?
Well, the broadest definition of a demonologist is somebody who studies demons. We tend, in our pop culture, we have come to look at demonologists as people who go around and try and exorcise these satanic demons, when actually it's a much broader field. You could be a demonologist and just simply study demons and not be engaged in much conjuring of demons or the exorcising of them. Christianity has tended to crystallize and concentrate things in a very narrow definition. Most of the magical grimoires, which would be conjuring books, the entities are often called demons, sometimes they're called angels, sometimes they're called spirits. They are entities out there of a variety of persuasions that, according to these texts, can be summoned for a variety of purposes. And even in demonic lore, there are some that are held to be the teachers of wisdom, the secret teachings and knowledge, and even the healing arts, as well as being more malevolent forces. The thing about demons is that, bottom line, they seem to have an unpredictable, uncontrollable, and trickster nature to them. So I think that even if you think you're dealing with benign or helpful demons, there's still that element that can go out of control. And I think this is where people get themselves into trouble by experimenting with conjuring. They think that they can always keep the upper hand, and they might conjure up something that can get away from them very easily.
Well, that's like this trickster energy that exists in, you know, in different pantheons like Norse and Native American. You have Loki and Coyote. I definitely know without a doubt there's a trickster energy in it. It's heavily involved in ufology. And I can also, you know, I thought about this before, but I'm thinking about it a lot more since we've been talking about the djinn, how some of these beings who are trickster-like can, you know, take on these forms, and some of them may be doing it just to have fun with humans. So it's, and that could go with UFOs as well. I mean, they could be, you know, some of this phenomenon, like Skinwalker Ranch and stuff. We talked with April Page Slaughter about that too. The stuff going on there, you know, the serpent in the lake, wolves, Bigfoot, you know, weird UFO refrigerator with creatures, you know, going around the yard. Definitely some trickster stuff going on, and I have a great interest in the trickster energy, and I know that a lot of people have talked about it in ufology, as well as I was talking about on break, the Coyote Native American tales. Coyote is sort of like their, you know, devil, sort of, but he's always, you know, there's a humor to him. But that the trickster theme throughout all of this is definitely something that is very fascinating to me, and I think people, not enough people are looking at it, that there is a trickster element, especially with, you know, everything with paranormal and UFOs on many levels.
I'd even go further to say that the trickster is part of the very foundation of the paranormal. Almost all of our engagements with paranormal phenomena have a heavy trickster element to them. And I think this is one of the reasons why so many things defy acclimation and also resolution. We can get all wound up over UFO waves and mysterious creature sightings and things like that, but there's very seldom any resolution. There's no, you know, where the proof is elusive. UFO waves go nowhere. They seem to build up in tension, and then boom, it's over like the exploding cigar. Researchers including myself, you know, we try and track things down, get on the trail of things, and just when you think something's the most promising, you wind up in a dead end, or you find yourself going in circles. And so is there a force out in the universe that just wants to have a big chain yank and a joke on things? Well, we find tricksters in all mythologies, too. So human beings have recognized this force since ancient times. And it seems to play a very significant role in cosmic order.
Yeah, that's kind of like, I mean, that's kind of like the person I am. I mean, I've said before, I mean, if I died and came back as a ghost, I'd be messing with people left and right. You know? Just having fun, you know what I mean? Just messing with their heads.
There seem to be all kinds of entities as well that don't want to do anything other than just have a joke or have a laugh. They haven't got any other purpose. And,
stupid humans.
We kind of wonder why things happen. You know, we're always looking for the big meaning in things, and there may be no meaning. There may be nothing other than something having a good laugh at your expense.
The great mystery. Some things you just can't figure out completely. As far as some of your investigations, what are some personal paranormal experiences with you that stand out that you'll never forget?
Well, I've certainly had a lot of them over the years. And you can't get involved in the paranormal in researching and especially investigation without having experiences. And, of course, a lot of these occur on a psychic level. I had psychic experiences when I was a kid. I think most kids do. They were probably more prominent for me because of other members of my family having marked experiences. So I was inclined from an early age to want to explore the psychic. I've encountered just about everything that I've researched. I haven't seen Bigfoot, and I have not been abducted to my knowledge. I have had encounters with entities that I would class as aliens or extraterrestrials. I've encountered demonic entities, jinn, shadow people, angels, fairies, and hosts of unknown entities that I simply have, ghosts of the human dead. And other entities that just fall into a class of unknown. What are they? You know, they might look sort of animalistic, but not quite animalistic, or they might be more forces or presences that have certain characteristics, but who knows what they are. I have been frightened on some occasions. I've never run screaming from a place. I have made prudent exits sometimes. Sometimes you're up against something that's very malevolent and very powerful, and it's more expedient to exit the premises. And I have encountered what I would call absolute evil, which was more a presence than an entity. And I think that I do believe that these things exist.
So since you were... I guess when you were a child, did you have experiences? What led you to get into the field of the paranormal? As a perception, as far as that childlike innocence of being able to see things, you know, it seems like society and adults, you know, try to get rid of that on some level with introducing you to the material realm. What led you to get so involved and be so passionate about the paranormal?
It was a combination of things. Most of my, what I would call paranormal experiences in childhood, I have no recollections of seeing any ghosts of the dead, but I did have experiences with beings that I defined as angels and fairies. And I think a lot of the invisible playmates that children have, it's not imagination, it's probably something that, coming from what we would call the fairy realm, they seem to have a major interest in children. And also the area of precognitive dreaming and astral travel and dreams. At a very young age, I became interested in dreams because my mother had a lot of precognitive dreams. She also had visitations from entities. And she didn't like having these experiences. My sister also had some experiences. For me, I was fascinated by this sort of thing, and I especially wanted to explore developing my extrasensory perception, and I studied it initially through dreams, projecting myself to distant locations in dreams or trying to see the future in dreams, and had some success at it. Not 100%, but enough success to convince me that these sorts of things could happen. I also had a voracious interest in science fiction and fantasy and the paranormal and horror from a fictional perspective. And at a very early age, I wanted to be an astronomer. And that really puts your mind out there into the cosmos. You have to go beyond the bounds of Earth to think about astronomical things. I had a passionate interest in mythology and I read all the classical mythologies, the Middle Eastern stuff, the Arabian folk tales. So all of these were very early influences on me. And when I got older and had some experiences, I wanted to explore what was going on and also why this was such an uneven playing field, why some people could have more marked experiences than others. And I was especially put off by individuals who attempted to tell me that I didn't have the experiences I knew I had. You know, it was all in my head, it was all my imagination, these things didn't exist. When I knew from my own experiences that they do exist. So those were all the things that led into this. And then over the course of time, I took quite a bit of training in energy healing and intuitive and psychic development. Because I wanted to be able to validate things more, and I don't really go into an investigation as a psychic per se, but I think any investigator who's truly attempting to understand the unseen has to engage the psychic faculties in some way. Consequently, these paranormal investigation teams who claim to be all science, all equipment, they're missing 90% of the action. Because equipment is not going to record most of the things that people have experienced throughout the ages.
Yeah, I see that a lot in paranormal and ufology. There's just this science side that's so science, it's just, it's nauseating. It's just too much science. I think there's a spiritual side to everything, and definitely that side kind of gets, away from in ufology on many levels, not from everyone, but from a lot of people. So as far as have you ever had any UFO experiences, like seen them or?
I have not. I have, I've often gone out sky watching. I've been sky watching in England and around the United States. I've never seen any lights in the sky that I felt were unknown. I have not seen any craft. I have seen entities that have what I would call an ET feel to them. And the thing is that when you're delving into the paranormal, things have different energy signatures to them. It's like the races of human beings. You know, we're all human beings, but we look different in various ways. And that's the same with the paranormal. So I have had encounters with entities that I would describe as falling under the extraterrestrial rubric. Again, it's often hard to be definitive about these sorts of things. And in fact, the deeper you go and the longer you go in this area, the less willing a real investigator becomes in terms of making definitive statements about a lot of these things. Which then becomes a target for skeptics to poke at, because science quantifies things in black and white. You're dealing with the paranormal. You're not dealing with black and white. You're dealing with a lot of shades of gray.
Yeah, I mean, with the paranormal, it's hard to know exactly what's going on. Same with ufology. There's always this guessing or, you know, speculation. It's hard to... I could see the djinn, too. Like, you know, they could be classified extraterrestrial. They supposedly came from the heavenlies, and that's where aliens come from. So, I mean, there's just so many different ways and perceptions and perspectives to look at. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I have seen what I would call mystery lights, you know, some sort of, light, you know, unexplained lights when I've been out doing investigations, but nothing that I would categorize as craft moving through the atmosphere. I did have some experiences in England when I went to, I've been to Glastonbury a number of times, and I've seen mysterious lights around Glastonbury, which seem to go in and out of the tour itself. But would these be the same as what we call UFOs? You know, doesn't quite fall into that category.
Well, that's like the wee folk.
Yeah, I mean, we have different explanations for mystery lights as spirits, souls of the dead, unknown life forms. I've seen moving orbs. I'm very skeptical about orbs in most photography. But I have seen what I would call moving orbs. That I can't explain, and I don't know what they are, whether they're an energy form that we haven't categorized or defined yet, or an actual spirit. Who knows?
So just for guys to tickle his belly button for a minute, what do you think about, do you think werewolves actually exist?
I do. Here again, things have been... I should say twisted in fiction, and I think that werewolves or dogmen, there's mythology about dogmen going way back to ancient times, and the werewolf would be more of a shapeshifter, you know, a human being who shapeshifts into the form of a wolf, whereas a dogman would be like a hybrid sort of thing. In fact, some of these creatures were described as having human torsos and the heads of dogs, sometimes the paws of dogs. But I think that these entities also exist in their own right in other dimensional realms, and they come into our world through a lot of the portal areas. And, you know, Linda Godfrey is probably the reigning expert on especially werewolves and dogmen in American sightings. And there seem to be a lot of these corridors in Wisconsin and Michigan. And she's done quite a bit of documentation of those.
I'll have to write her down there for possible interviews. So when's this interdimensional, what's it called? Are you doing that with Philip, or is that on your own?
The
book about portals?
It's called, the title is Multidimensional Portals. It's got a subtitle which escapes me off the top of my head, but it's something about the origins of paranormal phenomena or the origins of the paranormal. Is another book that I've done with Phil, and that will be out in December this year.
Nice. I've got to get Phil on sometime. It's been on my, he's on my bucket list. Definitely on the old bucket list. So is that basically just more detail about these portals and that you're talking about with the djinn and everything, just a lot more detail regarding the subject?
Yes, we bring some of our case studies into it. I've profiled a couple of places that are in portal areas that I think are heavily djinn haunted. We re-examine the Hudson Valley as a portal area, the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts, the Hockomock Swamp, talk about the characteristics that we feel define these, the sorts of things that that happen. And we did some interesting research, especially in the Hudson Valley area, where we tie in the stone chambers. And these are
mysterious chambers made by stone, which really date back, some of them, to Neolithic times. They were not colonial root cellars. The Native Americans didn't make them. In fact, nobody knows what they were really used for, but they dot the landscape, and people have odd experiences at them. I've had strange experiences in these chambers. They seem to be focal points in the portal areas, and we think that there are energy lines that crisscross these portal areas that serve as trackways for entities to come and go in the physical world, and that there also is a connection with the dead as well as you know, one of these other dimensional areas. So we did a lot of research in these portal areas with Frank's box technology, the ghost box technology, getting some very interesting real-time communication, and also some devices that Phil, being the clever scientist that he is, made to measure certain kinds of readings and energy. By the way, I consider EMF meters to be rather useless as a paranormal tool. They're too easy to manipulate, and they pick up too many extraneous sources of natural EMF. It becomes very problematic to get what I consider to be valuable readings off of them. So I don't use EMF meters in my investigations.
Hey, Rosemary, we have about 2 minutes.
Okay. So hold on. I just want to thank you, Rosemary, for doing the show. I definitely consider you a legend in the field in my eyes, and thank you for doing the show. If you want to give us your links real quick before we depart again.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the show. Visionaryliving.com is my website. Lots of articles, including a gin page, a blog, a newsletter you can sign up for, and, of course, my calendar of shows and presentations. And as of early February, we'll be going live with our gin website, ginuniverse.com, and that's spelled DJINNuniverse.com. But we've also pointed different spellings to that designation as well. Articles about the gin and some tips for taking them into account in paranormal investigation.
All righty. Well, thanks, and very grateful to have you on the show, and we'll be in touch again, hopefully, to get you on again when you get more other books out. Let us know if you want to do another round with us.
I certainly would like to, and I've got lots of things coming out this spring, and would love to come back on the show and talk about some of these other topics.
All righty. We'll talk to you, and we appreciate it, and stay warm in Connecticut.
Thanks, Jeffrey and Guy. It's been a pleasure talking with you tonight.
All right, good night.
You too, hon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Fare thee well, good people. Fare thee well. Are we over?
I didn't
think so.
The
good wee folk. What is that noise?
I know, we got some goopy phone thing going on.
I think it's Joe looking at midget porn.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology